Rain and thunder fell upon the Greeks. The sea to the left of the closely packed army loudly crashed against the beaches, while the towering foothills of the Syrian mountains overshadowed their right flank. War horns sounded from the massive Persian colossus on the other side of the river. Alexander sat upon his trusty horse, head held high, and the red plume of his helmet gusting back in the wind. He stared down the enemy. He looked back at his men, some shivering while clutching their long spears. It was all within his hands, everything he had dreamed of since a child. All he had to do was take it. Alexander pointed his spear at the menacing Persian army, yelling back to his men. The Battle of Issus had begun.
We shall fight in the fields and in the streets. We shall fight in the hills. We shall never surrender.
Господин председатель, это что, для вас открытие? Весь мир знает, что самая империалистическая держава – это Соединенные Штаты Америки.
Yesterday, December 7, 1941, a date which will live in infamy.
I'm Mahip Mahil, and welcome to the first episode of Traces Through Time, a brand new podcast highlighting the greatest historical figures and events in an easily accessible format for all listeners. This is the first part of a two-part series on Alexander the Great. As you begin listening to this episode, however, you may have a question. Why Alexander the Great? Who cares about a person who lived almost 2,300 years ago? Why is he still relevant to our world? What will you gain from listening to me rant on Alexander's exploits? As we begin our journey, I thought it was appropriate to tell the story of not only one of the most influential men in ancient Greece, but possibly the greatest historical figure ever. Alexander conquered lands far and scarcely known by the West, arriving at the outer reaches of the known world. By the end of his life, his empire spanned from Greece in the north all the way to India in the south, and from Egypt in the west to Uzbekistan in the east. Reaching nearly 2 million square miles and 3 separate continents, Alexander's conquests brought with it Greek civilization, traditions, government, and politics to the rest of the world. He was the world's first ever conqueror, uniting lands from all over under one name, his name. Yet what's most captivating about Alexander, especially to a modern audience, were his unique traits matched by no one in the world. His ambition, energy, and fearless leadership were at their absolute peak. Despite being only 16 years old, Alexander had already begun leading armies and destroying rebellions. His courage was like no other, in a time where kings would happily sit at the back of the battlefield, protected by layers upon layers of bodyguards. Alexander was frequently the first man leading the charge, as you'll see in just a little bit. Now, what do I want you to take away from this episode? Is it all the names, the dates, and the people involved? No. Is it every battle formation Alexander used? Not at all. Is it perhaps to tell you how great of a storyteller I am? Well, kinda, yeah, that's the point. But in all seriousness, it's Alexander's traits that are of the most use to all listeners. All of these traits, the courage, the leadership, and the unbelievable energy, as you'll see during his early life and conquests, are important for everyone to acknowledge and adopt in their own life. While learning about Alexander's military exploits may seem a drag, it informs us on what we can incorporate from his story into our own lifestyle. How can we be better leaders? How can we be more motivated people? And most importantly, why? Now, before we begin, I'd like to note the sources used for the making of this episode. I mainly referenced the Anabasis of Alexander by Arrian, The Histories of Alexander the Great by Quintus Curtius Rufus, and Life of Alexander by Plutarch. Various modern estimates have also been added. These sources have been listed on the show notes if you'd like to do some more research of your own. Now that the stage has been set, let's transport ourselves back 2,300 years ago to the golden age of Greek civilization. For years before Alexander's birth, Macedonia had been considered a backwater. Macedonia sat in northern Greece, a ways away from the mainland, and looked down upon by the age-old powers of Athens and Sparta. It wasn't much respected by these latter powers, who believed Macedonians to be semi-barbarians and barely even Greek. However, Alexander's father, Philip, had become king of Macedonia and modernized, to say the least, the heck out of it. He conquered nearby lands, introduced strong military reforms, and had made Macedonia a strong regional power by the time of Alexander's birth. Moreover, a major goal of Philip's, and generally of all Greeks at the time, was to avenge the humiliation of Greece at the hands of the mighty Persian Empire, the superpower of the ancient world. If you watch the movie 300, you'll know all about those Spartans who screamed, "This is Sparta," and kicked a guy down into a well. But what you probably don't know is that after defeating Leonidas and the 300 at Thermopylae, the Persians had reached Athens and burnt down the sacred Acropolis. This had triggered a desire for revenge within all Greeks. A major reform of the Macedonian army was the technological advancement of its weapons, specifically the Sarissa spear. Think of an 18-foot-long stick, fixed with a blade at the end. It was much longer than spears of the Greek hoplites, or infantry. These spears had been given to men organized into tight squares called a phalanx, basically a near-indestructible ancient military formation. This is important as the phalanx proved to be the centerpiece of Alexander's own military conquests. Alexander III, as he was known then, was born on roughly July 20th, 356 BC. His father was Philip, the king of Macedonia, and his mother was a princess from the nearby city-state of Epirus, a woman named Olympias. However, legends and superstitions shrouded Alexander's birth from the very beginning. According to Plutarch, the bride, Olympias, and the night before the consummation of her marriage with Philip, had felt a thunderbolt fall upon her womb, causing a flame to spread far and wide. Ancient scholars interpreted this as Zeus, the famous god of lightning and thunder, being the true father of Alexander, implying that Alexander, then just an infant, was a demigod. But before I go on, first remind yourself of you as a 7-year-old. What did you do as a child? I used to run around and scream at the top of my lungs, play hockey and other games, and not ask people what they thought of a neighboring king. Well, Alexander did the exact opposite. As he grew older, Alexander began to show signs of his remarkable traits. He used to entertain Persian envoys in the absence of his father. He wasn't as childish as a kid, instead asked thoughtful questions regarding the length of roads, what sort of man the Persian king was, and how his skills as a warrior were. This intelligence of his was nurtured by the great Aristotle from 13 to 16, causing him to be well-versed in poetry, philosophy, and literature. You may have also heard the famous story of Alexander and his horse, Bucephalus. The story goes like this. A horse trader had brought a horse to Philip's court and offered it to the king for 13 talents of silver. A tidy sum of money in that time, even for the powerful King Philip. But Philip questioned why he would pay the price. The horse appeared to be a savage, is unmountable, and kicked off anyone who tried. However, a young Alexander, watching the horse, understood what no one else seemed to understand. He walked up to the horse, shaking off the fearful exclamations from the court, took Bucephalus, and faced him towards the sun. He had noticed that the horse had simply been scared of seeing his own shadow. Alexander then mounted him and began riding around in circles in the court. Philip, in turn, had begun crying, declaring that Alexander must find a kingdom big enough for his own ambitions, as Macedon was too small for him. He was in wrong. Alexander's storied military career had begun at the mere age of 16. He was made regent, or basically the caretaker king, while his father went off campaigning. Alexander was thus given full charge of the kingdom and the army. Yet, while Philip was away, instability occurred. The Medi, a Thracian tribe in Macedon, had rebelled. Most regents in this case may have waited for the king, especially if the regent was only 16 years old, and the king was their father. But what do you think Alexander did? Well, Alexander took his army and put the rebels down himself, driving away the entire population from the border of Macedonia. And, just to rub it into the old tribe there, he founded his first city, Alexandropolis, on the old settlements. So, just to cover that, at 16, he had defeated warrior rebels all by himself. And moreover, the city was only the first of 20 more to come. Alexander had a further chance to prove himself on the battlefield when Philip took him to fight an Athenian-led Greek alliance in the south. The Macedonian army marched through the countryside and met the Greek alliance of Athens and Thebes on a sweltering summer's day near the village of Chaeronea. Alexander had been entrusted by his father to take command of the entire left wing of the army. He was already a trusted general of his father's, despite being only 18 years old. I mean, at 18 years old, I'm recording a podcast episode about Alexander. But as the battle began, Philip, controlling the right-wing infantry, attacked the Greeks. Ferocious fighting took place as men from both sides fell equally from battle wounds as well as the high heat. The Macedonian infantry then began deliberately and slowly retreating. The Greek alliance, thinking they had begun to overwhelm the Macedonians, began pushing back more and more. As the Macedonians retreated, however, and as part of the alliance's army followed, a gap appeared between the Greek city's formation. It had devolved into two distinct lines, and Alexander, seeing this opportunity, charged with full force with his cavalry. He smashed it into the flanks of the Athenian and Theban infantry, while Philip, noticing his son's cavalry charge, began to take out the rest of the Greek alliance's infantry. The Athenians and Thebans, seeing the Macedonians surrounding and destroying them, turned and ran. Philip and Alexander had won. Nearly 2,000 allied soldiers lay dead on the field near Chaeronea, a stunning victory for the father-son duo. After the battle, the rest of the Greek city-states fell under the umbrella of Philip's Macedonia. The League of Corinth was established, a Hellenic, or Greek, alliance with Philip named as the hegemon, or the supreme commander. Plans were then announced to finally invade Persia, the age-old enemy of the Greeks, and to carry out a retribution that had been planned for more than a century. But before anything could happen, Alexander had begun to get into hot water with his father. Alexander had always been stubborn and had a violent temper, as either his way or the highway. However, Philip, in 337 BC, a year after the Battle of Chaeronea, had decided to marry a new wife, Cleopatra. Now, this isn't the famous Egyptian queen, this was way before that. But this Cleopatra was the niece of one of Philip's generals, Attalus. It was here, at the wedding banquet, that the father-son relationship had finally begun to show signs of deterioration. At the banquet, a drunk Attalus loudly asked that the marriage between Philip and his niece produce a legitimate successor to the kingdom. Alexander, who was technically only half Macedonian due to his mother's Epirusian ancestry, was furious that his legitimacy as heir had been called into question. He angrily threw a drinking cup at Attalus, calling him a bastard, when it was actually implied that he was a bastard. A furious Philip, angered at his son's outburst, and also very drunk, took his sword out, but he tripped and fell as he made his way to Alexander. Instead of aiding his father, Alexander looked over to the king and mocked him, saying, "See there, the man who makes preparations to pass out of Europe into Asia has overturned in passing from one seat to another." This was the last straw for Philip. Only the intervention of Alexander's friends allowed for his quick escape from the wedding. After self-exiling in a nearby region for almost 6 months, Alexander was finally brought back by Philip after being persuaded by a family friend. Yet, there wasn't any time for reconciliation. Alexander III became King of Macedonia at the age of only 20 years. Philip, his father and the king for 23 years prior, had been assassinated by his own bodyguard in a court struggle. Alexander, much loved by the soldiers and the common Macedonian folk, was proclaimed king on the spot. Now, it's important to understand that in this ancient Greek age, it's very common for new young kings to experience rebellions in the early years of their reign. Many expected Alexander to be rocked by these inevitable rebellions. They thought of him as an able Greek general, but not one of particular political skill and ability. But, like most things, Alexander, they couldn't be more wrong. Alexander began consolidating his position as soon as he became king from the very first day. He already had the widespread support of the Macedonian soldiers, as he had been a brave and courageous general for the 4 years prior. So, to further maintain his grip over the kingdom, he began to purge it of all his rivals. On his instructions, his general Parmenion killed Attalus, the man that had offended him at Philip's banquet. Alexander also had killed a number of other potential aspirants to the kingdom. Even a cousin of his couldn't escape the new king's wrath. His mother, Olympias, had Cleopatra, Philip's newest wife, as well as Cleopatra's newborn daughter, both burnt alive. And, just like that, as soon as his coronation, Alexander had already cleaned house. However, the Greek states, ill considering Alexander's ability, had also gone into rebellion against the new Macedonian king. Alexander, quick as a flash, burst into Greece. The Thessalians, one of the people that had rebelled, were quickly overcome in a mountain pass. According to Curtius, Alexander came into their rear so quickly that the Thessalians had no choice but to surrender. At Corinth, the Greek cities voted to make Alexander hegemon of the League of Corinth, just like his father. From here, Alexander quickly made his way to the Balkans to quell rebellions there. However, as soon as he got there, he heard that the Athenians and Thebans had rebelled once again. So, once again, Alexander sped back to Thebes. It was at Thebes where Alexander made one of the most controversial decisions in Greek history. To prevent another rebellion in his absence, he ordered the city to be razed, burnt completely to the ground, and plundered. Only priests and pro-Macedonians were released. Nearly 6,000 civilians lay dead, 30,000 sold into slavery. After this brutal repression of the Thebans, Athens cowed into submission. Now that Greece was firmly quelled from all rebellion, it lay firmly in the hands of Alexander. Alexander, however, was not quite done. In fact, this wasn't even the beginning. Persia was next. The exact numbers of Alexander's army for the invasion of Persia vary. Arrian says 30,000 infantry, including archers, with 500 horses were included. Modern historians instead estimate up to 48,000 infantry and 6,000 additional cavalry were brought with Alexander. 60 ships were used to transport Alexander's massive army across the Hellespont, the place where the continents of Asia and Europe meet the closest. Alexander, a man obsessed with superstition and spirituality since a young age, sacrificed a bull in the middle of the Hellespont crossing. He was the first Greek to step out of the ship in full armor onto the land of Asia. Then he threw a spear into the Asian soil, proclaiming, "I accept Asia as a gift from the gods." It was May 334 BC. Alexander's army approached the river Granicus. The local Persian generals, satraps or governors, and nobility had decided to give battle to Alexander. The Persians, thus, were lined up on the other side of the river Granicus. Alexander's generals advised him to set camp for the night, and to not risk a full crossing of the river in broad daylight. The Persian cavalry, feared throughout the entire world, could have attacked while they emerged from the river disordered. Alexander, however, as stubborn and fearless as usual, refused, instead calling the rushing river a mere brook. The Macedonians, on the other side of the river bank, had placed the phalanx in the middle, with the cavalry on either wing. Alexander led the right with his so-called companion cavalry, with his general Parmenion leading the left. The Persians on the other side lined the riverbank with 20,000 cavalry and 20,000 Greek mercenary infantry, soldiers originally from Greece that had been hired by the Persians for money, in the rear. Alexander particularly disliked these mercenaries, who, in his mind, had so willingly decided to fight their own countrymen with a few pieces of gold and silver. All was quiet. The Persians waited for the Macedonian advance. Finally, Alexander ordered a charge of the Macedonian right at the Persians across the river Granicus. Trumpets sounded as the Persian threw missiles at the incoming Greeks. The Persian cavalry, seeing the Macedonian horse crossing the river, countercharge, smashing into the Macedonians. From the very get-go, the Macedonians had begun to suffer. Horses and men fell alike in the river as the water splashed with the pounding of thousands of units of cavalry. Alexander himself, however, was coming with the companions. He attacked the bulk of the Persian forces, where the majority of the leaders were all bunched up in one. Horses jammed the river crossing as Alexander's men finally began to gain the advantage, thanks to their superior strength and military discipline. The years of fighting under the young general proved crucial. They followed him to the very end. Yet Alexander had become stuck in the middle of the fight. As he fought off a Persian horseman, another Persian noble crept up behind him, raising his weapon against the king, poised to kill him. Suddenly, Clytus the Black, a good friend of the king's, came up behind him and slashed the noble's entire arm off, sword and all. What would have happened had the Persian noble been successful in his attack on the king? I guess we'll never know. The Persians were now being well and truly repulsed. The Macedonian infantry had caught up to the horses and were inflicting substantial damage to the Persians. Suddenly, the Persians broke, turning around and fleeing. Instead of chasing down the fleeing Persian cavalry, however, Alexander ordered the Macedonians to encircle and destroy the remaining Greek mercenary infantry. Alexander, furious that these Greeks had turned on their fellow countrymen, ordered them all to be killed. "20,000 Persians fell, according to Plutarch. It's actually probably 5,000 to 6,000 according to modern estimates. Only 100 Greeks had died in the battle. 300 shields from the fallen Persians were sent back to Athens to decorate the Acropolis. Alexander had won his first major victory against the Persians. Western Asia Minor, or present-day Turkey, sat wide open for Macedonian conquest. With no considerable land armies facing Alexander now, the Greek army began its march into the rest of Asia Minor. Within Asia Minor, there are multiple major cities that lay on the Mediterranean coast. To consolidate his foothold on the continent, Alexander decided these were to be conquered first. The Persian fleet was still a considerable threat to Alexander, as it could cut off his supply chain and lines of communication from across the Aegean Sea and prevent him from moving fast towards the heart of Persia. So, it was vital to take out the major coastal fortresses and cities in Asia Minor. Most cities Alexander came upon with his professional Greek army immediately surrendered and laid down their arms. Sardis, the provincial capital of that region of Asia Minor, immediately surrendered, handing over the entire citadel and treasury to the Greek invaders. However, the city of Miletus, now on the southwestern coast of Turkey, held firm against the Greeks. Alexander, understanding that time was of the essence to lift the Persian hold over these major cities, besieged the settlement. Finally, following regular assaults, which included Alexander once again, ignoring the pleas of his advisors and generals for caution and restraint, the Greeks finally captured the city. Alexander moved on towards the ancient city of Halicarnassus, where one of the seven wonders of the ancient world stood, the mausoleum of Halicarnassus. The city once again had to be besieged, and after the final Greek assault, a great fire enveloped and burnt down most of the city before it could finally be captured. Alexander continued on his campaign of taking the rest of the coastal Persian cities to continue to rob the Persian fleet of its base power. Once he had done this, including taking all the major sea bases on Turkey's Mediterranean coast, Alexander moved north, inland towards the city of Gordium. It was here that the legend of the Gordian Knot came true. To explain it simply, the Gordian Knot was a long, complex knot tied to an ox cart. Legend had it that the man who untangled the knot would become the ruler of all Asia. Alexander, coming up to this knot, began to study it. He looked at it from every angle, trying to figure out a way to untie it. Many hundreds, if not thousands, had tried before him, and all had failed. Finally, Alexander simply took out his sword and slashed the knot into pieces, thereby untangling it. Later that night, thunder and lightning shook and lightened the night sky. The gods had approved. Alexander made tidy work of central Turkey, easily capturing Paphlagonia and Cappadocia, two ancient provinces, and then beginning the descent into Cilicia, near the present-day borders of Turkey and Syria. However, news had come from Syria. The Persian Shanshah, or King of Kings, Darius III, was coming from the south. He was within 100 kilometers, maybe, of the Greeks, and along him were, according to some estimates, such as by Peter Green, more than 100,000 men, outnumbering the Greek force by more than 2 to 1. Plutarch claimed the number was close to 600,000, yet this is probably just a pipe dream. Alexander, after recovering from a threatening illness in Cilicia, initially made way towards present-day Syria. However, Darius came up behind him and captured the town of Issus, mutilating the small Greek force that had been stationed there, yet more importantly, threatened to cut off Alexander's lines of supply and communication. Alexander had no choice but to face the Persian king. In 333 BC, the Battle of Issus, one of the most important of the wars of Alexander, was about to begin. The battlefield was in a narrow coastal pass, with the coastal Nur Mountains to one side and the Mediterranean Sea to the other. A river, the Pinarus, separated the two armies. The rain had begun pouring heavily. Alexander, with the mountains to his right and the sea to his left, formed his army much in the same way as he had done at the Granicus, with the phalanx in the middle and Parmenion leading the allied cavalry on the left. He himself led the companion cavalry again on the right. The Persians had, also, a deep Greek mercenary phalanx in the middle, cavalry on the right wing and strong Persian infantry on the left. The numerical advantage of the Persians was clear to the Macedonians. They filled up the entire 6-mile coastal plain. Yet, unlike Alexander, who led his men from the very front, Darius was in the back of his army, surrounded by the legendary immortals, the king's household soldiers. You might remember these immortals from the movie 300. Now, before I tell you what happened, think of what you would do if you were in Alexander's shoes. Your army isn't even half of the enemy Persian army, and yet you have to convince your men that they can do it. They can not only engage the world's major military superpower in battle, but also come out victorious. Though he had already proven his leadership in prior battles, it was really here, at the Battle of Issus, that Alexander's leadership and tenacity became a thing of legend. It's here that his applicability to a modern audience becomes clear. Alexander began to ride around his front line, yelling in his native Greek tongue, motivating his men and lifting their spirits. He called out his soldiers by name, challenging them to fight well, not only for themselves, but for their mothers, their wives, and their children. On the other side of the Pinarus, Darius simply watched on at the small Greek army, and the mere child leading them. Suddenly, as with all the force in the world, Alexander led the charge of the right-wing Campanian cavalry across the Pinarus River. As the Macedonian horsemen emerged from the Pinarus, what a sight it must have been to see. Laser-focused Greeks on horseback riding at full speed at the enemy Persians. They only had one major focus, speed and shock. Alexander's headlong mass cavalry charge struck the center of the Persian infantry on the left flank, quickly overwhelming them. The infantry soon routed and began to flee the battlefield. However, in the other dimensions of the narrow battlefield, the Macedonians were not faring very well. The Macedonian phalanx suffered great losses in the first few minutes of the battle as it came out of the Pinarus River. The Greek mercenaries were pushing the Macedonians back. Meanwhile, the Persian cavalry had charged at Permanian and its left wing of allied horsemen. They now were beginning to crumble underneath the sheer numbers of the Persian horse. Yet the dogged Parmenian fought stubbornly, maintaining the cohesion of his troops under the massive Persian onslaught. Seeing the pressure put on his Macedonian center phalanx, Alexander ferociously turned the companions and charged at the Persian center, combining with the Macedonian phalanx to overwhelm the Persian infantry. Then, straight as an arrow, Alexander shot towards deep into the middle of the Persian army, followed by his trusty Campanian cavalry, charging directly at Darius. He fought his way towards the Shanshah, who had been stationed near the back. However, instead of fighting the fearless lion Alexander, the sheep, Darius, the king of the great Persian Empire, turned around and fled in his chariot from the battlefield, scared for his life and abandoning his own loyal soldiers to a grim death at Macedonian hands. As news spread that Darius had fled, the Persian army began to crumble and rout from all sides. Thousands of Persians started to flee. The very earth quivered as the men ran back behind their king. The Greeks chased after the routing Persians, slaying them where they stood. In a single swoop, and against a much larger Persian force, Alexander had seized victory in a battle that seemed unwinnable. He had been shrouded in legend and spirituality since the very moment he was born. He had shown his mettle since he was a young man. And finally, at only 23 years old, he had begun to dismantle the greatest empire known in the world. Despite his stubbornness and occasional temper, his energy, passion, confidence, and leadership ensured that he truly was different from all else. He truly was Alexander the Great. I've been Mihip Mahil, and thank you for listening to the very first episode of Traces Through Time. If you liked this episode, consider leaving us a rating and a review. Follow wherever you listen to podcasts, and join us next time for part 2 of our Alexander the Great series to discover what happened to Alexander following the Battle of Issus.